Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, at our house, supper begins by grabbing whatever falls out of the fridge first. So last night it was chicken thighs and leftover Chinese dumpling sauce. That sauce is just soy, vinegar, and sesame oil, but it occurred to me that it can take you anywhere. As in, grate ginger into it, tease open a head of iceberg so it looks like a rose, pour in the sauce, and you've got a Canton salad. Or put sriracha in the sauce with some brown sugar and try cooking carrots in that. Now for soup, add lots of broth to the dumpling sauce, along with noodles and bok choy and tofu. And you've got supper. Well, stay with us. There's lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com, turning your photos into works of art. Get your favorite photos on gallery canvas. Visit easycanvasprints.com/splendidtable to receive 50% off your canvas print.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, we're tweeting and texting all over the world, but it's surprising how clueless we are about the famous food people in other countries. Take the woman England called the greatest food writer of the 20th century. Her name was Elizabeth David. She died in 1992 at age 79. But in the 1950s, she took on the stodginess of English cooking like a fighter going for the Golden Gloves. Well, a collection of her recipes has come out. It's called At Elizabeth David's Table. Ruth Reichel, the former editor of Gourmet magazine, wrote the preface. Ruth, welcome.
It's great to be here.
So, Ruth, who was Elizabeth David for you?
Well, for me, she was the person who really introduced me to a world of food. I mean, it's very hard for us today to remember the way American food used to be. It was gray, it was brown. And Elizabeth David was about freshness. I mean, she was modern food personified, way ahead of its time. She brought Mediterranean food to the English and to young Americans fortunate enough to stumble upon her like I did at 16. Mm-hmm. A world of food that I didn't understand, that I had never encountered. I mean, the idea of just some pasta tossed with chilies and oil and garlic. I mean, that in the 60s was not the way we thought of spaghetti, or just a tomato sort of eaten simply, you know, just because it was so delicious all by itself. She was a person who had an enormous impact on people like Alice Waters. And she literally changed the way England eats.
Can you place her in time for us? Because her first books came out in the early 50s.
They did. First of all, for me, she was this wonderful wild woman. I mean, I grew up around American cookery writers who were all good girls. And Elizabeth David was not. She was, you know, she was from a very fancy English family, but she was sent off to live with a French family when she was 16, and it changed her forever. And she came back and shocked her family by wanting to be an actress. And then she ran off with a lover to take a boat around Europe, a yacht. And they landed in Naples on the day that Mussolini declared war on the British.
So we're talking the late 1930s at this point.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And she spent the Second World War in Egypt. And when she got back to England in the late 40s, she was so depressed by the rain and the stodge of the food, as you say, and the brownness. And, you know, England still had rationing, so it was very grim. And to cheer herself up, she wrote a cookbook that was a memory of being in Italy and Greece and Egypt. And she brought sunshine to the table. And, you know, the Britons, I think it was like a romance for them.
They worshipped her.
They did, and still do, in fact. The English preface to this book is an appreciation by every great English chef, you know, Jamie Oliver, Nigella Lawson. I mean, all of them saying, you know, this is the most important food person in my life.
So what exactly was her food about?
It was sensual. It was about the difference between, say, Elizabeth David and Julia Child. Is Julia Child is all about technique. You know, Julia Child believed it. You could go to the supermarket and make great French food if you knew how to manipulate those ingredients correctly.
Right.
Elizabeth David is all about the ingredients. You know, her food is go and get fresh things and do as little as possible to them. Do no harm.
Did you ever meet her?
I met her once, and she was a famously difficult woman. She did not suffer fools. And so, you know, here I am, this young food writer. I had just started, and I was invited to a dinner. She came to San Francisco, and she was she lived up to her reputation as being difficult. And I was thrilled because I did not want her to be nice. I didn't want her to be sweet, and she was not. You know, she was a woman who, you know, loved to drink, loved to eat, but, you know, had standards. And, I mean, for her, food was, I think it was really a romance. It was, you know, it was about savoring every minute of your life. And she got angry at bad food, which is what I loved about her so much. And she was very, I mean, her writing is just spectacular. And she also was completely unpretentious. You know, her idea of a great meal was a picnic by a waterfall with a lover. And, you know, I can't tell you how much in the 60s when it was all about fancy French restaurants, what a breath of fresh air it was to have someone say, you know, to eat a slice of a fresh tomato on buttered bread with a little bit of salt while you're sitting in the outdoors was better than any restaurant. What a shock that was, and what an inspiration to a cook.
Oh, Ruth, I can't wait to dig into this book. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
It was really fun.
Ruth Reichel is author of Garlic and Sapphires. Now, Elizabeth David's recipes are collected in a new book, At Elizabeth David's Table. And to get an idea of how David took dishes down to their simplest and their best, try her Sussex stewed steak. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, register for our monthly book giveaway. This month's book is Bean by Bean by Crescent Dragon Wagon. Register on the website. You know where that is, splendidtable.org. Karp has been trying to track down one fruit for 13 years. Now, he's tasted over 1,000 varieties of this kind of fruit, yet he says this one is the standout. Well, David's been called the fruit detective. He researches at the University of California at Riverside, and he writes for the LA Times. David, good to have you back with us.
Good to be with you.
So, 13 years looking for a fruit. What fruit are we talking about?
We're talking about the fruit best known as the decapon, a mandarin and orange hybrid, three-quarters mandarin, a quarter orange. That's large. It's got a little net like a Mignola tangelo, but it's lighter in color and has bumpier skin. And it's also incredibly delicious, the most delicious of all the 1,000-plus varieties I've ever tasted. It's high in acidity, but even higher in sugar, with an intense, very pleasant, complex aroma that's reminiscent of the kind of canned mandarin oranges that we got.
Right.
But this variety is, it's not just my opinion. I went to China a couple of years ago, and I asked the director of the National Citrus Collection in Beibei near Chongqing, which was the most delicious of the citrus, of the 1,200 varieties of citrus he had in his collection. And he looked at me as if I were asking a stupid question. Shiranui, of course. And now, Shiranui is the original cultivar name, the scientific name for the Decapon. Decapon is just a marketing name they dreamed up in Japan. Deco means bump, and pon as in pancan, which is the type of fruit that it's derived from. And it's now being marketed here in California as the Sumo, which is, again, just a local marketing name.
Well, you sent me some, and I've got one right here, and I'm going to try to taste it.
It's so easy to peel. And the other thing is that, unlike many types of tangerines and hybrids, the oil does not express on your fingers. You could open it up in the back of the car, give it to your kids.
Okay, so you can take apart the sections. It doesn't look like there's any seeds. Let me taste it.
Completely seedless, and the membranes are gossamer thin. Often, when you eat a mandarin, there's a lot of chewy rag, as it's called technically. In the case of Decapon, it's firm to the palate, but then it dissolves. It almost melts in your mouth.
This is really very, very good. It's very subtle. Pineapple, orange. This is really interesting. Now, all right, but tell me, why did it take 13 years for you to uncover this thing?
Well, when I first spoke to a fellow named Brad Stark Jr., who's a citrus grower in Strathmore in the citrus belt of California's San Joaquin Valley.
Right.
And in December 1998, Brad Stark Jr. was very excited about this variety. He said this is the best citrus variety from Japan. He had to bring it in through the University of California has a special program for, you can't just bring in any citrus variety. That's strictly illegal. But if it's brought in through proper quarantine channels and then cleaned up, then after 3 years, you can take the budwood for grafting and propagate an orchard.
Okay. So meanwhile, you're protecting against pests and that kind of thing.
His company actually went out of business due to various different factors, and it became unclear just who had this budwood. So it became a search, and it was unbelievable. Nobody would talk to me about it. I went in search of a scientific collection where there was said to be decapon trees, and when I got there, the trees had just been cut down. I knew for the first time the true meaning of the word stumped. I called the farmer who was supposed to have custody of the budwood, and I had just spoken to him a week before. He wouldn't return my calls. Then I spoke to the head of a leading citrus nursery who knows everything about everything in California citrus industry, and finally he gave me an indication of what was going on. He said, David, there's some very heavy hitters who are not happy that you found out about the Decapon. This was about 5 years ago, he said. They're anxious to grow it themselves and not have anybody else know about it, and they want to have a head start so that nobody else can grow it in competition with them. Whew, I was kind of, yeah. I'd never heard of this kind of secrecy surrounding a simple fruit.
So, I mean, this sounds like you're dealing with people who put out contracts on people.
No, this guy's a friend of mine, and I didn't think that anything like that was going on, but
right.
It did cross my mind for just a second. When I finally tasted it, it was actually not until 5 years ago at a scientific collection in California. It just blew my mind. I dropped a little bit of juice on a refractometer, a device for measuring sweetness in fruit, and it measured 20, which is like 5 points more than I'd seen in any other citrus. I thought that my refractometer was broken.
You're the only person I know who packs a refractometer. But so, David, it's now available in stores?
Well, a couple of years ago, this group obtained the budwood, started propagating orchards. They now have 435 acres, most of which just started to bear this year, and they may be planting more. This year it was available from like mid-February to mid-March, mostly in California with a few shipments going elsewhere. But next year they're going to loose this upon the world, or at least upon the United States. So it will be widely available and worth looking for under the name Sumo.
Okay. Well, David, thank you.
You're very welcome, Lynn.
David Karp writes for the LA Times and researches at the University of California at Riverside. Well, I was reminded this week of the power of the can. Have you ever fooled around with chipotle chilies in adobo? Now, these are those hot, smoky chilies canned in a tomato vinegar sauce. They come from Mexico. Well, there's a fabulous sauce that you can make with them. It's sweet, hot, and kind of mysterious. You can't quite nail down the flavors. Now, here's the basic idea, and you do this to taste. This idea, by the way, comes from a recipe by Padma Lakshmi. You know, she's the host of Top Chef. In a food processor, puree together the chipotle chilies in adobo, garlic, tomatoes, apricot jam, vinegar, and a little soy sauce. Now, once you've made up this mixture, you can spread it on a tortilla. You can roast a chicken in it. You could toss it with fresh oranges and cut up jicama and have a fabulous salad. Now, we're going to post the idea on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with BFF Wines. These are the ones that will never let you down. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com. Take your favorite family photos, pictures of the kids, or those amazing vacation photos, and have them printed on gallery canvas like you might see in a museum. Starting at $19.99, you can have a beautiful gallery canvas print for your home or office. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com/splendidtable to receive 50% off your canvas print. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You could call Josh Wesson the original wine maverick. He was the master sommelier who just never bought into the snobbery. In fact, he proved that modest money could buy very good wine. Josh, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me back.
You know, Josh, I'm thinking you live and breathe wine. You've got to have some of the dependables, you know, the wines that you know are always going to work. What are your picks in that category?
Well, when I think about, you know, wines that are reliable, I think about best friend wines, BFF wines, let's call them. These are wines you can always count on to be there for you. And the very first wine that comes to mind as a BFF would be a sparkly wine from Spain, Cava. These wines are just always delicious, always ready to turn any event into a special occasion. They're invariably affordable. They're all over the place. You can find them in any good wine store, any good supermarket, and they really deliver on their promise of deliciousness without charging a lot.
Well, what about names, though?
Well, you know, sparkling wines from Spain come in different styles, just like sparkling wines from France do. The driest ones are called Brut, and one of my favorites is from Segura Viudas. All the sparkling wines in Spain, by the way, come from the northeastern part of Spain in Catalonia. And Segura Viudas' Brut Reserva, it's just my go-to sparkling wine. I love to get it in big bottles and magnums. You can buy it for about $15, $17 in a giant, beautiful bottle.
A magnum for $15, $17?
I know. It's just incredible. And the bottle is insanely beautiful. And the wine inside is incredibly delicious. It's dry. It's palate cleansing. It smells of apples and pears. It's great with a million foods and with no food at all. And it just is, it's such a reliable wine. It's absolutely my house sparkling wine when you come to my apartment. That's what I'm going to serve you for a glass of bubbly.
More BFFs?
Sure. Malbecs from Argentina. If you like big, rich, fruity red wines that are easy to drink right out of the bottle. They don't need to be put in a blender and they don't need to breathe. You don't need to spend a lot of money on them, although you can certainly spend a fair amount of money on high-end Malbecs. The vast majority of them come from the region of Mendoza and they sell between $10 to $15 and they just over-deliver on their promise of juicy red deliciousness. I had an Alamos Malbec for $10 the other night with a pizza of all things, and it was just delicious. But I can count on one hand in all the years I've been in the wine business that I have been disappointed by moderately priced Argentinian Malbecs. They always deliver.
That's really saying something.
Grafina is another one. The Centenario Malbec for about $14 is delicious. And the Navarro Correas, the private collection, costs $10. Now, it can't be that private a collection because it costs
$10. Yeah, $10. They're awfully democratic for a private collection.
But, you know, if you give it as a gift, people think that it's a private collection. They don't see the price, of course, when you're giving it as a present. And they'll open it up and think the world of you because these wines are just chock full of dark berry fruit and a little bit of smoke, and they have just enough tannin to cleanse the palate of, you know, meaty dishes and fat. And they're just delicious. They're fun to drink. They really are fun to drink wines.
One more BFF.
I'm going to give you two very quickly, white wines. Sauvignon Blancs from the South Island of New Zealand, from Marlborough, are just delicious palate-cleansing wines. They're usually modest in alcohol. They're full of racy, bracing acidity. They go with lots of dishes, from grilled vegetables to fish and shellfish. And I have a trio that I love for about $13, $14. They all Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand pretty much cost the same when you're getting them at entry level from there. I don't know why, but they're all $12 to $14. Oyster Bay from Marlborough, fantastic wine.
Uh-huh.
The Brancott, also from Marlborough. And my personal favorite is the Private Bin Villa Maria from... where else?
Marlborough.
And these wines are just, incredibly delicious with everything. I mean, I love them. They're my go-to white wines. But when I want a wine that has a kiss of sweetness, because there's a lot of food that we eat these days that has a suggestion of sweetness, you need a little sweetness to go along with that, I turn to Washington State, and I go to the number one grape planted in Washington now, which happens to be Riesling.
Oh, yeah.
And they specialize in off-dry Rieslings, even though they make dry Rieslings. So if you don't mind a kiss of sweetness in your wine, go to Washington State and just revel in the deliciousness of things like the Snoqualmie Naked Riesling for $12, or the Hoag Genesis Riesling with its beautiful kiss of sweetness. And if you want a world-class Riesling that'll hold its own with fantastic wines from Germany, spend a little bit more. Go all the way up to $18. And get the Eroica Dry Riesling from Chateau St. Michel. It's a combination of German winemaking from the Luzon estate and the grapes from Chateau St. Michel, and it is just like the best kiss you'll ever have.
Hear, hear. Hey, Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
Josh Wesson's BFF wine list is on the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael hunt down good local eats all over the country for their road food site and for us. Jane, Michael, hi guys.
Lynn, hi.
Hey, Lynn.
So where have you guys been? What's the latest find?
Well, not only have we been, but we've been back to the Southern Kitchen in New Market, Virginia. This place holds a very, very special meaning to us because it was probably... maybe one of the first of 10 restaurants that we ate at when we were researching the original road food in 1975. And I remember their specialty is peanut soup then and now. And
we had never heard of it.
It seemed
like
the most exotic thing in the world, at Smithfield ham. And, you know, we have changed. Michael and I have changed. We've aged. We've grown. We've shrunk, whatever. But the Southern Kitchen has stayed exactly the same.
They still have country hams hanging from the coat rack, which I remember when we first went there, we thought that was so amusing because we didn't realize how important country hams were in this part of Virginia. But you walk in, there's really no room to hang your coat because it's occupied by beautiful hanging country hams.
So the peanut soup.
Have you ever had it?
I've had peanut soup, but what is this soup like?
The tricky thing, we've had a lot of peanut soup since we first found this place. And at its worst, it's just like watered-down peanut butter. You know, it can be awful.
Yeah,
but in fact, at its best, it's got that earthy kind of sweet, nutty sweetness of peanuts.
African taste to it.
It is African, and in fact, the use of onions gives it that kind of caramelized sweetness that balances the flavor of the peanuts. It's actually quite elegant, you know, as opposed to being thick.
Mm-hmm. It's more like a consommé, almost like a chicken consommé that does have a very piquant peanut and onion flavor to it. And it does not fill you up, so you are certainly able to eat fabulous fried chicken and...
Or country ham
afterwards.
And I have to tell you, on the side, especially of the country ham, the one side dish you must get at the Southern Kitchen is stewed tomatoes. Now, stewed tomatoes can be really boring, but
right.
Here they're stewed to death to the point where it celebrates the fact that the tomato is a fruit. It's almost like a fruit compote that so balances the saltiness of the country ham. It's a fantastic combination.
So the stewed tomatoes are actually sweet.
They take them down to the point
where that sweetness comes out.
Exactly. And you know, the ham, as you know, it's not super salty country ham. Virginia is somewhat more moderate in its saltiness,
right.
But the combination of the ham and the tomatoes with a couple of biscuits on the side, this is Southern eating at its best.
You know, it's great to know there are some things that never change. The Stearns are authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Thanks for checking in, guys.
You're welcome.
All right, Len. Bye-bye.
Find their weekly picks on the website, splendidtable.org. It's possible that Chad Robertson bakes the best bread in the United States. Rhapsodies are written about his crust and his crumb and the taste of his wheat. Now, he and his wife, an equally skilled pastry chef, by the way, have a little bakery in San Francisco called Tartine. So here's the question. Where does a baker go who's at the top of his craft to learn new things? Well, we're checking in with Chad in his kitchen at Tartine. Chad, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
So, Chad, where does a baker go who's at the top of his craft? Where do you go to learn?
Well, for me, I wanted to go to a place where they were making bread that was very different from what I've been making for the last 15 to 20 years, and also a place where I was interested in the food and the sort of indigenous grains that they've been using and sort of reviving. So that led me to Denmark. And sort of the northern part of Denmark, there's a baker there named Jørn Ussing who found all of these ancient ryes and wheats, and he's sort of bringing them back, and they're all Scandinavian varieties with high protein and easy to digest and just really beautiful, beautiful grains. So that was my first place, and I'm going to go back in a few months and bake more with him.
What did you learn from him?
I just learned that there's so many different subtle flavors amongst even different kinds of rye. In the States here, when I work with rye, we sort of think of dark rye or sifted rye.
Right.
There they have, you know, all these subtle different flavors of rye with different, you know, levels of protein. And when you ferment them, they taste different. And they have the same thing with wheat. Some of the older spelt and einkorn and emmer wheats that are, again, very nutritious and easier for people to digest. They're a little more difficult to work with, but I really actually like that challenge.
Right.
With these older varieties, you really have to have skilled hands sort of working with this to get a loaf of bread that looks like what we expect modern bread to look like. You know, whole grain doesn't have the greatest reputation. You know, it's almost like you choose whole grain for health reasons, not for flavor or texture or aesthetic reasons, and I'm really trying to change that. I want people to choose whole grain because it looks beautiful and it has this amazing flavor, and so I'm researching what are the angles of that. I mean, starting with some of these older varieties of grain that have, you know, really nutty sort of rich flavors, and then making bread, sort of the process of making bread through different techniques of fermentation to sort of make them lighter, bring out more flavor, bring out some of the subtle flavors of fermentation, and make a beautiful loaf of bread. So I sort of started to find that this whole grain world is much larger than I previously had known. So it's fascinating to me.
Chad, you also were in France, and I know you studied there originally, but you went back. What was the main thing you picked up on this trip?
I went back to France recently to reconnect with a baker that was a mentor of mine that I worked with 15 years ago named Patrick Laporte, and he's in Brittany now. And back then he was pretty radical when I first worked for him, because he was using all whole grain, organic, stone ground flours, and of course he's still doing that now. And just going back to work with him 8 months ago and tasting this flavor of these stone milled flours. In France, stone milling is really an art, and it's a very, very serious craft, a profession. And just tasting the flavor, the sort of fat that goes into the flour when it's very skillfully stone milled, it reminded me why that's important, as far as just getting the whole nature and richness that's within that grain into the flour. And then when you make your bread, you know, it's still there, and you just have these rich whole grain loaves that are almost fatty, you know, in a good way.
So the way most grain is ground here is between metal rollers, right? And it's just a different process?
Yeah, roller milling is very efficient, and it works quite well, but it definitely gives you a different product than stone milling. And so it was good for me to be reminded, because there's certainly a place in modern bread making for these exquisite stone ground whole grain flours, and that's the other thing that I'm sort of working on now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chad, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Chad Robertson is co-author of Tartine. Now, you can find a recipe for Tartine's buttermilk scones on the website, splendidtable.org.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? You should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are open. We're taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email at splendidtable.org. Dan is calling from Minneapolis. Dan, what is on your mind, sir? What would you like to talk about?
Hello. Yes, I'm calling today because myself and some coworkers are organizing a soup cook-off in the office.
Yeah?
And this is our second one, and we have a few more entrants. So we thought we'd try to define some parameters of the soup cook-off this time around. And so we've decided on categories of a broth and a creamy, so there'll be awards for both those.
Right.
But the question came up about soup versus stew, and we couldn't really define what makes a soup and what makes a stew, and, you know, I guess it's kind of a gray area for us, and we wanted to figure that out.
Oh boy, you know what it comes down to? If you have to eat it with a spoon, you can call it a soup.
It's that simple.
Yeah, I think you have to make it that simple. Otherwise, it's going to get so complicated. I think that's where you draw the line. You know, if there's a lot of liquid in the chili, it's no longer a stew. It's a soup. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And obviously, the other thing is that things in the soup are cut to a size that you can have them on a spoon. But it's the amount of liquid. So, yep. You know, that's how I would define a soup versus a stew.
All right, so it's kind of open-ended in that sense.
So you've got categories of what? Creamy soups?
And some broth soup.
Right. And then big soups, so to speak. Hearty soups.
That would be a good idea to add that.
Because that would be your sort of stew/soup.
Absolutely.
So how many entrants are there going to be?
We have about 12 so far. So there's a good number of offerings on the table.
Well, Dan, good luck, and may you be one of the winners, and I hope it helped.
Thank you very much.
You
take
care.
It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Pleasure to talk to you, too. Bye. It's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what does Kraft cheese have in common with WikiLeaks? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're going to get back to talking with you in a moment. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what does Kraft cheese have in common with WikiLeaks? Well, according to Wired magazine, their common denominator is where they store their stuff. They store in caves. WikiLeaks keeps its secrets in a former nuclear shelter under the streets of Stockholm. Kraft sends its Velveeta, its singles, and everything else to a huge cave in Springfield, Missouri. No surprise that it's not for flavor development, just for storage. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook. We've got Amy on the line from Tucson. Amy, hi. What do you want to talk about?
New Mexico.
Oh, golly.
Hatch green chili and red chilies and making really good bases for them.
Oh, you're bringing back memories. Oh, yes. Boy. We used to live in Colorado and go down. Never got as far as Hatch, but New Mexico chilies. Oh, boy. Now, do you go there?
I actually grew up in Albuquerque.
You did.
I do go there fairly often, and I actually used to live in Colorado for a while, too. And I was really excited because I was thinking, oh, I'm going to Tucson. It's going to be wonderful. I'm going to get some flavors at home. It's completely different. A lot of the chilies are treated like a side spice almost. So they're kind of hidden. And in Albuquerque, you know, they're with the Hatch chilies, it's the main feature.
Right.
So you drown your food in the chili and the cheese, and it's almost like the hot wing culture, where it's like, how hot can you get?
Yeah, exactly. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, Hatch, New Mexico is one of the great centers for New Mexico chilies. And if you, you'll often see bags of long, dried red chilies. They're very long, and they're dried, and they're sold as New Mexico chilies, and they can range from fairly mild to quite hot. And there are a lot of other chilies grown in New Mexico, but these are the ones that are very famous, and they're often maybe 6 inches long, 5 inches long, right? Right, Amy?
Yes, definitely.
So they
can be huge, the big gym ones, yes.
So are you asking me, because you're a native, what do you want to know? Because I have a feeling this is like bringing coals to Newcastle.
One of the problems that I've had, and I thought you might be able to answer this, is a lot of times, a lot of the recipes, and I know a few expats that we've all tried to trade recipes, and we find that there's not that richness to it, to a lot of the chilies that we try to make. A lot of the standard recipes we find, you have the green chili, you have chicken stock, you have cumin, you're kind of making a light roux with the onions and sometimes a little bit of olive oil. But the problem is that the stock is just not rich enough with these recipes. And my suspicion is that it might be a pork stock or something.
Well, pork stock would be a mainstay.
Right.
Pork stock would absolutely, I mean, I'm thinking of, there's a dish called pozole that's done with the hominy corn.
Amen.
Yes, yes. And it's done with chunks of pork and green chili. And it is, you know it well. And for anyone who's not tried this, this is a stew/soup that will make you weep. And it's a case of, it's a pork stock. It's pork and bones cooked in water very, very gently. And the green chilies would be roasted first to get rid of their skins, the fresh chilies. And if they're already roasted, you know, if you're buying them frozen or whatever, the idea would be that those go into that stock kind of toward the end of cooking. But there's another method, too. If you're using red chilies, what you want to do, those dried long red chilies, and this applies to almost any red chili that you're going to use, whether it's from Mexico or New Mexico, is the first thing you want to do is lightly toast them. Right? So you put them over the gas flame or you put them under the broiler. You don't want to burn them, but you just want to toast them a little bit. And then you put them in warm water and you let them soak. And when they get soft, you take off the stems. You can leave the seeds in or not. You know, the seeds are going to just add a bit to the heat. You drain them completely and then you puree them with a bit of water and garlic and oregano. You want to make a thick something that's the consistency of heavy cream or a little bit thicker. And then you cook that. That's what you cook down until it thickens and it becomes really, really delicious.
And what does the oregano do for it?
The oregano is an aromatic, and it has that lovely sort of pine-like, almost mint quality to it, musty quality, but it's very attractive, and it's kind of classic. Some people would put in cumin or coriander, but and some people would fry up in some pork fat or in oil or butter some onion and then cook that chili puree in it. And that's I think it's called chili colorado. Now, I haven't cooked New Mexican food or been in New Mexico in a long time, and I have no doubt there will be emails flooding in from people saying, you know, you really didn't get that right, but it's pretty close.
Okay.
And that's your red chili, and that can go over anything you have. And if you want to, you can take that and you can toss that with pork and let it sit, chunks of pork shoulder, and let it sit overnight, and then slowly cook it with a bit of water in a pot. And when it's cooked down again and it's clinging to that pork, you pan fry it in its own fat, and you will have such a dish like I can't tell you. But anyway, give that a try. Give that red chili a try. The toasting is one of the big deals.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you are welcome. And I feel for all you expats. I love
it's
that idea.
It's a tough thing. Very
yeah, it
tough
really
thing.
Is. It is. It is. Thank you, Amy.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us at 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Scott is calling from Mason City, Iowa. Scott, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I love the show.
Well, thank you.
I grew up north of Kansas City, where chasing the wily morel mushroom is either a science or a religion, kind of depending on your perspective. And actually, on a calm day in the woods, I can locate them by the sense of smell.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now that I'm up in North Iowa, I've been blessed every year with between 10 and 50 pounds per season.
You could buy a house with what that costs in the market.
Well, my dilemma is, besides pan frying or using them in a prosciutto or onion soup or, of course, mushroom soup or oyster stew,
right?
I end up with an abundance of some that are partially pan fried and frozen,
right?
And then also dried. We use them, you know, most of the summer, and they're an amazing hit at the New Year's Eve party.
Oh, I can imagine they are. And they dry really nicely. And, you know, when you reconstitute them, they're really delicious. I mean, I don't think you lose a lot with a morel when you dry it.
Well, when I rehydrate them, I either use milk or a cheap dry white wine.
That's a great idea. I've never tried that.
I tend not to. I tried oil one time, but you end up with a little bit of organic material that is sometimes a little suspect.
Yeah.
I noticed that they seem to blossom in a clear or a white sauce, either dried or fresh, but tomato just seems to overpower that rich, nutty flavor.
Yeah, that it does. It does.
So have you got any ideas?
Well, this is my classic combination with morels is hazelnuts. Because they share a similar quality, that nuttiness. And now hazelnuts have one problem. Often they go stale very quickly, so you sort of can't buy hazelnuts without tasting them first. But one of the things I've done with them in the past is I slice them in sort of wide strips and then take a combination of butter and olive oil. And I kind of poach a bit of garlic in that. You know, I cut garlic into, half-inch pieces.
Sure.
And just put it in there and kind of stew it until it's soft. Pull that out, and you don't need a lot of fat. But then roll the nuts, the skinned hazelnuts, and the morels in that. And a lot of morels. You know, the hazelnuts are a seasoning. They're not the main event.
Sure.
But and you want to toast those hazelnuts in that combination. You add the garlic back in and you take the smallest amount of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. You just shave some furls over that. And if you want, you take some really delicate pasta and you toss that with the pasta.
Ah.
Now that is something that the gods would appreciate. In all, you know,
that sounds amazing.
In all humbleness, but in, you know, really, it is just incredible. And what this really is a takeoff on what is done with porcini mushrooms, you know, in Italy. But I mean, a morel, and I think there's another cue that A morel, for instance, works really beautifully with delicate meats. And I'll give you an instance. A chicken breast, you know, from a chicken mm-hmm. with taste, slowly cooked with morel mushrooms would be just fabulous. Maybe just a little shot of dry sherry in there. And I'd throw those nuts in. I mean, I just think those nuts would be wonderful.
Well, I have tried a chicken meatloaf with the morels.
Oh.
And that turned out really my wife wouldn't eat it, but it was pretty good.
You have the luxury of having more morels than anything else in that meatloaf. You know, where the meatloaf is holding together the morels.
Precisely.
Yeah, and I think that would be utterly wonderful. Imagine if you sautéed lots and lots of shallots and then boiled down some red wine so that it was really thick. Mix that in with the meat and the seasonings and lots of morels. That would be just fabulous. And don't call it a meatloaf. Now it's a pâté. And you're going to serve it on little triangles of toast. And your wife will utterly love it, and so will everybody else.
I really appreciate it.
Okay. Hey, enjoy the morels, and know we're all envious.
Thank you.
Bye. You can reach us. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or pick up a phone, 800-537-5252. We've got Libby on the phone from Conway, Mass. Libby, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I want to talk about my pathetic pie crust. I have really low aspirations when it comes to pastry, but it is so depressing for me to blind bake a pie crust and then take off the foil and have this crust that I actually put some effort into shaping just slumped down the sides of the pan into this sad, greasy coil at the bottom. You can totally imagine, you know, the odd little sad finger stretching up, still trying to cling to the side. And I have tried everything to make it stay up. I fill the pan to the brim with my dried beans, and I make sure to chill it either in the fridge or the freezer. I've tried both before I put the pie crust in.
Uh-huh.
I've tried tenting the foil up like a little awning above the edges so that there's no danger they're going to get squished. And yet it just melts in there, and I'm not sure what I'm missing.
You've just made a creature out of that pie crust,
maybe. I've been baking a lot of pies this winter, and so I've had a lot of opportunity to feel my pie crust pain.
Okay. Well, just in case, if you're not a baker, baking blind means you bake the crust empty, and which crisps it, and then you fill it or you bake it again with a filling. But the idea is you're partially baking it or baking it all the way. Okay. So let's backtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use a lot of different kinds of pie crust recipes, or is this one you've been using fairly
well,
good?
I have tried a variety of them. I never use shortening because it scares me. So they're always butter-only recipes.
Right. Okay.
And the one that I used most recently was actually the one from your site, because I was baking the 20-ingredient pie.
Oh, that's Melissa Clark's.
That's right. It was on the show this fall.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. Okay. Number one, whenever you move a pie dough, meaning mix it in any way, you want to chill it and mm-hmm. let it rest, because that keeps it from being tough. And that also keeps it from shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you roll out the pie dough and put it in the pie plate, you need to give it a minimum of 30 minutes in the fridge.
Okay.
Okay. The other thing is, with your pie dish, usually it has a rim on it.
Uh-huh.
When you put the dough in, really leave an overlap of dough. Okay. So you you take the rolling pin and you lift the dough and you put it in. Trim the dough around the outside so there's still about a half inch to an inch of dough hanging over the side.
Okay.
Fold that over onto the rim to make a slightly raised decorated crust. You know, you can mm-hmm. flute it between your fingers. You can just pinch it. But it's raised now slightly. And you've got a really firm, fairly thick amount of dough on that flat rim that goes all around the pie crust plate. Then give it a complete chill. It has to totally relax, because I think one of the things that's happening with this is that maybe the dough hasn't had a complete rest and it's still springy. You know, the gluten is still stretched. So as soon as it hits heat, it goes boing. The other thing is, you line it with foil, and you should weight it. I just put the weights all, you know, I just put dried beans or rice or whatever. I've used the same dried beans and rice now, I think, for 20 years. But, I mean, you know, I mean, why throw it away?
I know, that makes me feel better about my dried beans.
Yeah, I mean, if you saw, I mean, it's pathetic. But, I mean, but that doesn't matter. The idea is that you want to just, you know, make sure that that pie is weighted down so that the crust is going to not puff up. Mm-hmm. And then what temperature do you bake it at?
Oh, boy, I think this one was probably 375. Some of them are started out higher and crank it down. And
okay, so you're blind baking, meaning you're starting that crust first,
mm-hmm.
and then you're taking it out the oven, letting it cool, and then you're doing whatever next step you're going to do.
Right.
Okay, so I would do it at 400.
Okay.
I would give it about 10 minutes or so before you try to lift the foil. And after 10 minutes, lift it out of the oven and very carefully peel back the foil. If the crust looks like it's all, you know, the butter's melted and it's mushy,
mm-hmm.
put it back in the oven for another 5 minutes. In so many words, don't try to remove the foil until the crust has firmed up.
Okay.
I think you may be removing the foil a little too soon.
All right. Well, I think of these ideas, I think the one that I probably am most guilty of is not leaving enough dough around the edge.
Yeah, you want to give it a good grip.
All right. Thank you.
You are welcome. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Margaret Atwood. She said, in spring, at the end of the day, you should smell like dirt. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Getten. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Holacek. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.